So, this is my story, and I've titled it Captain Stretch and the Case of the Fried Egg. You may wonder why I've given it that title, but I hope it will become clear as I go through. Now, many of you might know that I keep chickens. You may not know this. This particular little chicken was Ethel. This was one of the first chickens that we had. We got her as a rescue chicken. And she came to us virtually oven ready, with no feathers. I know. But that's just to give you a little flavour of the fried egg. A little fact that many people don't know, actually. A chicken will only lay one egg a day. You'd be amazed at how many people don't realise that. But the poor chickens, they'll lay one egg a day unless it's winter, and then they hardly lay any at all. So that's my chicken fact. But you might be saying, OK, well, why the fried egg? So fried egg's really important in my story. A couple of years ago, we had an inset day at church, at school, and we were told about the fried egg. Go back to my little fried egg picture. And a fried egg, if you look at a fried egg, you can think about it like your life, a fried egg, a moment in your life or a short time in your life. When things are going well and you're in your comfort zone, you're right there in the yellow, in the yolk, where there's lots of food and you get fed. And it's really comfortable. So that's your comfort zone. But then as life begins to get a little bit difficult, you step out into the white of the egg. And that, at school, we call the stretch zone, hence Captain Stretch. And the stretch zone, it's different sizes at different sides of the egg. Sometimes it's very short, but sometimes your stretch zone is much greater, and you travel through that white for much longer. And that's, for me, is like the picture of life as it gets tricky from time to time. We have to face our fried eggs. So I've got lots of fried eggs to share with you. And I'd like you to be thinking about fried eggs when you're doing answering the questions and your own fried eggs. And then as occasionally in life, life gets really, really difficult. And you get to that part of life where you feel that perhaps the walls have fallen down around you, the sand is shifting from underneath your feet, and on the fried egg, you know, if you cook a fried egg too quickly, you get that little crispy bit around the edge. I call the frilly zone, and that's the real danger zone, and that's where in times of real difficulty, sometimes we just don't know how to cope with things, and it's not pleasant to eat the. I don't find it pleasant to eat that little crispy bit, and it's not pleasant to be there. And so through my life, I've had a few of stretch zones and a few frilly zones, but I've had a lot in the centre there in the yolk. I shall share some of just my early life with you in a moment. Now, I got a bit worried back in January because I came along one Sunday morning and Keith was doing a talk on the Sunday morning about grace, and I sat there and I thought, it was about a week or so after I'd been asked to do this talk, and I've jotted down a few ideas about what I wanted to say, and lo and behold, Keith stole all my ideas. So it'll be a bit of a test for you tonight to see if you can remember anything that Keith said. But one of the things that you said, Keith, Keith was talking from 1 Corinthians about Paul. He had about having a thorn in his flesh, and he asked for the thorn to be taken away from him. But during that time, Paul realised that his power came from the Lord, and he said, "For when I'm weak, you are strong." And actually, God's power is made perfect in our weakness. And when we go into that stretch zone, when we're into that frilly bit, we need to realise that God's power is at its greatest when we're at our weakest. So that's Just something for you to think about, really, as I talk. And we can't really do much in life without the kingdom of God and without God's grace and power. And those are the things, Keith, that I stole from your talk, which you stole from mine. But for the kingdom of God, again, is a very, as you'll see, is really important. Understanding what that kingdom means is really important for me and my story. Now, I know lots of you know some of the story as we've lived here at St. Paul's and been part of the fellowship here. And it's quite easy for you to think about maybe my life and my life in Neil. It's been tricky. I've had lots of challenges, but it hasn't always been hard. So I'm just going to share you a little, you know, tell you a little bit about my early life. Okay, so I grew up in a place called Endon. It was a little village in just outside Stoke-on-Trent in the Staffordshire Moorlands. It's a very pretty little village, lots of farmland. Neil said, oh, we come from bumpkin land when I first met him. But those are some pictures of my childhood. There's a canal there. We used to go down there and play. You wouldn't be allowed to do that, I'm sure, these days. But my mum would just let us go off, and we'd take a little picnic or our bikes, and we'd go and play around there. And I think my brother once fell in it, actually. And there's a little, really pretty little church there. That's the parish church, St. Luke's. And the little picture with the flowers on, it's a well. Each year they have a well dressing to give thanks for the water that never dries up, actually. And it's a really nice festival. They have a well dressing queen and a fairground and everything else. So that's where I come from. And this is my childhood. I had a very happy childhood. That's not quite all my family, but that's my mum and my dad. My brother Mark, there in between them, looking like he's up to mischief, if you can see that clearly. He was always up to a bit of mischief, Mark, when he was younger. And then me and my sister, Jackie, on the left, and I'm there sat on my dad's knee, my brother Mike, and I think my brother Simon must have been taking that photograph. I seem to remember it was in Dovedale. We went out for picnics there in Derbyshire. So I lived on, Endon's very close to the edge of the Peak District. So on bank holidays and other days like that, we'd often go out for picnics. That's me and my sister, Jackie, as babies. So I'm a twin. I'm actually the oldest twin. Now, I'll tell you, that counts for something. I'm 13 minutes older than her, which technically makes her the youngest in the family. But I had a very happy childhood. That's all my brothers there. So I'm one of five, and that was our dog, Honey. It was, you know, blissful childhood. Nothing actually troubled me during my childhood, really. I was actually brought up a Catholic. My dad had a very strong Catholic faith. And I went to a Catholic convent school run by nuns with a few secular teachers. And the parish priest there was Father Tolkien, who's the... He was the brother of J.R.R. Tolkien. So that was his, you know, very, very eccentric man, actually. Very nice man. He used to wear these glasses that he had, those little round National Health glasses. And he had one set, and then he wired another set, just the lenses, over the top to make his glasses stronger. And that's me and my sister. I was 7 years old then. That was my first Holy Communion. And my Auntie Ethel made the dresses. They were very fashionable, very 19s. Well, I guess that would be in about 1970, early 1970s. So happy childhood. Brought up a Catholic, but as I grew older, when I was about 13, the younger of my brothers, Mike, who is the one just behind me and my sister in that picture at the top, he became a Christian. So he was around about 17 and we were about 13, and he came home full of his faith. And my dad nearly had heart failure, being a staunch Catholic. And he just couldn't really get on with it, couldn't really understand it at all. And in fact, he actually sent him off to see the local parish priest to talk to him about how awful it was that he'd left the Catholic faith. But my brother luckily stuck to his guns, and he actually became a Christian, started going to the little church in Endon, St. Luke's there. And from time to time, he used to invite us along on a Sunday evening. They had like a youth group, and so we'd go along. And I guess that was my first exposure, proper exposure to the Christian faith, because being a Catholic, it's all very, very liturgical. You don't really have to think about it. The priest would do his little talk. It was rather meaningless to me. Even though I went to a Catholic school and we read the Bible and we learnt the Angelus, which we'd have to stand up at 12 o'clock and recite and did all this stuff, I didn't really understand it at all. But when I went along on to there on a Sunday night, it was completely different to my other faith experience. They'd sit around drinking cups of coffee, maybe sing a couple of songs, probably a bit more what we're used to, actually. Share a bit of the Bible, chat about it. And I began to learn a few things. Really, really enjoyed it until my dad put a stop to it. And that was sort of the end of that at 13. But I never lost that yearning and never lost that quest to find out a little bit more. And as I moved on to, as I became a teenager, I'm not quite sure what the next picture is. All right, I'll come back to that in a moment. As I became a teenager and grew up, I was still questioning. I went off to university, still questioning. I found lots of other people in the same boat as me who had either, some had some Christian experience, but most people didn't. And we would stay up till late at night talking about things of faith and how we felt there was a lot more to life than what we'd experienced, but we could never quite find the answer. I even got invited to some Christian Union things, and me and my friends would all go off to these Christian Union talks and love it, really interested, but we never quite found it. And I tell you these things because I was about, well, university, what, 18, 19, and I've been searching since I was about 13 or 14, but I never gave up that quest, and that's to really encourage you. You know, sometimes it takes a long time for the lost people in this world to actually find their faith and to get there. And I actually didn't find my faith until my mid-20s. But before I tell you about that, here comes my first fried egg. So this is a picture of my dad. My dad always looked older. I'm not quite sure. He was probably in his 50s, when probably a similar age to I am now. It's giving my age away, isn't it? His early 50s, but he always looked like an old man to me. but my dad, he, unfortunately, he became ill when I was in my, late teens, and I didn't really understand what was wrong with him. I just observed that sometimes he'd get forgetful, and sometimes he'd get cross more easily. You know, his he'd get frustrated with himself, frustrated with us. My mum would get cross and frustrated with him, a little bit embarrassed by him sometimes. And I remember watching a program on the television, and it was one of these science, I've always loved a science program, as Neil will tell you. And it was a medical program. It's stories of these people with, and I remember watching it thinking, gosh, that sounds like my dad, the behaviours that he was demonstrating. And I'd be around about 17 or so, 16, 17 at that stage. And they mentioned the word dementia, and I'd never heard of it before. And then I went off to university, and going away from home and coming back every sort of holiday through the term time, it became more and more apparent to me that my dad was becoming more and more ill. And unfortunately, he had early onset dementia, which he got in his early 50s. He lived with it for 10 years, actually, and died when he was 64. So I was in my... I was around about 24 at that point, I think. when he died. And that was quite a big thing, seeing him deteriorate, become more and more ill, the stress and strain that it put on my mum. She was at home with him. And my brothers were local. I was down here in London. My sister was up in York at university. And she continued to live up in York and got a job up there, as I did down in London. So the strain was very much more on my brothers and my mum and dad. But it was difficult, you know, taking difficult decisions on behalf of your dad. We'd have to talk about it and work out what was the best thing to do. And in those days, thankfully they don't have them now, but in those days they still ran mental health hospitals. So he eventually ended up in the local mental hospital, which was, at the time, seemed like the right place because it was the only option available. But when I look back on it, it must have been terrible for him. And unfortunately for him, his father had had the same illness, and a couple of his older... He was the youngest of seven, my dad. And he knew it wasn't where he wanted to be because his sister and his dad had been there. So it was a really terrible decision. So he died when I was about 24. And I think when you're younger, when a parent dies, although it was very hard, it's a bit easier to cope with. In my experience, I've found that when you're a little bit older, it's a bit of a different thing, actually. I think you're a little bit more resilient, probably. You perhaps don't think quite as deeply as you do when you're a little bit older. But I might be wrong. It might be different for different ones of you. So that was sort of my first Friday. It stretched me. You know, I was in an area where I didn't really know how to handle it. But luckily for me, by then, I had come to faith. I came to faith. I'd started going to a Baptist church, actually. I'd been going to the local Catholic church. I lived in Lewisham with my friends, and I've been going to a Catholic church in Lee Green and quite enjoyed it. And then we moved to Broccoli. So I started going to the local Catholic church in Broccoli, which was awful. Nobody said hello to you. It was just awful. And in the end, I just stopped going because I didn't find it a very uplifting experience or very interesting even. And then a friend of mine said, why don't you come to the Baptist church? We've started going to this Baptist church. And I said, okay, might as well. I'm not going to church anywhere else. And I really, really enjoyed going. For the first time, I walked in that first night. It was completely different. They sang loads of songs, which I'd never sung before. Very similar to what we see to sing here today. And I loved singing the songs. It made me feel better. And then the pastor got up and spoke. There was none of this stand up, sit down, do the liturgy. Just not a scrap of it there. He then got up and spoke, opened up the Bible, and for the first time ever, I actually understood what he was talking about. And for me, that was almost like a seminal moment in my life, to be able to go to church and think, well, there is a bit more to it than just all the routines and the rituals. And that started me on a journey, a two-year journey. So you think I'd started when I was about 13. By this stage, I was around about 22. And I kept going along, and the more I went, the more I liked the people who were there, and I was observing them and thinking, well, they've got something in their lives that I haven't got. I was really aware of that. And this is a word of encouragement for home group leaders now. We noticed on the pew notice that our next door neighbour's address kept appearing on the pew sheet. We had no idea what it was. This thing on a Tuesday night, a group would meet. So me and my flatmates, there was four of us, we thought, well, we'll just go round there, bearing in mind none of us were Christians, and introduce ourselves. So we knocked on the door one Tuesday night, and they were having a home group, which we didn't really know what a home group was, actually. They opened the door and we said, oh, we live next door. We've started coming to your church and we've noticed your address keeps appearing on the notice sheet. We thought we'd just come round and say hello and see what you're doing. And they were a bit surprised and they said, oh, come in. And so we came, we all four of us went in, sat on the floor, and they were doing a study from Revelation, and I now realise that the guy who was running the home group sort of went a bit pale. And we were really fascinated by it. He started to almost apologise and say, oh, it's, you know, perhaps we'll change what we're doing. We were like, no, you carry on what we're doing. And we were amazed by what they were talking about. We were so hungry for it. So we said, do you mind if we come again? And they were like, no, sure, fine, come. And it's just, you know, a word of encouragement, really. Never underestimate the hunger that people who don't know the Lord have. You know, because me and my friends, we all became Christians through going to that church and through going to that home group. It took us varying amounts of time, but they welcomed us in, and we would come and we would share our lives, warts and all, with them. At the prayer time, we were like, right, straight in. You know, and you could see someone thinking, goodness me. Because we understood that these people had something, they could pray for us, it made a difference. And it just built more and more faith in us, even though we weren't quite sure what we were looking for. Anyway, so to move on, 2 years it took me, 2 years. I was sitting in church one Sunday evening, and the chap at the front was preaching. I was about 24 at this stage. I'd just come home from Club 18 to 30 holiday. It had been quite an experience, actually, for me and my friends. And he was preaching on Matthew 6, verses 25 to 34. And it's the bit in the Bible where God says, do not worry. You know, the birds of the air, they get fed. The lilies of the field, they're clothed in beautiful colours. But the verses that stood out for me were these, where it says, can't quite read it. So seek first, I have to come around here to read it. But seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. That particular verse was the one that spoke to me. And I remember sitting there thinking, well, that's interesting, but how do you seek the kingdom of God? You know, what is that all about? And then something really odd happened. The young guy who'd been preaching, one of the elders in the church, got up, came up to the front and said, oh, I think he'd finished preaching. He said, oh, I think you've forgotten something. And everyone sort of shuffled in their seats and looked a bit surprised. And he said, you need to explain how to seek the kingdom of God to people. So he then told me that the way to seek the kingdom of God is to turn around and just say sorry first for the things that you've done. And although I must have heard that, that was the first time I've really understood it. So I thought, okay, I'll just sit here and say sorry. So I sat there in the pew and listed a few of the things that I felt I needed to say sorry for. And at that moment, my life transformed. I sat there in the pew, not really expecting anything. And I just had this sense of God's presence. And I just knew that my life was never going to be the same again. Something, I felt excited. And I rushed up to one of the elders at the end of the service and said, I think I need to get baptised. And he was like, hold your horses. Why? And I explained to him, and I was baptised within, I don't know, a month of that. And I've never looked back. And from the very next day, you know, my whole experience of life had changed. The way I looked at things, the way I looked at my relationships with other people, my desire and hunger for God just mushroomed. And having been to that church for 2 years, thinking, what have these people got? They've all got something. I just suddenly understood what it was that they had. And it was that relationship with God, coming to God and repenting for those things, just enabled me to step over that threshold into God's kingdom. And that particular verse has been really special to me and has continued to be special. And the next verse where it says, and therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. So through, and this was about the time shortly after my dad had died, and that's where I began to learn about that verse and hold on to it for myself. So that's how I became a Christian, how I came to faith. And around about the same sort of time, very, very shortly after, I met Neil. So that's our wedding day. We both had Beetle cars. And there's a bit of a funny story about that white Beetle. It was a pearly white open-top Beetle. I don't know, is Song Yang here today? No, he'd like this. I had a red Beetle and Neil had a black Beetle and he offered to fix my clutch. So he did. And he was on an Oasis team, actually, at the church plant from the church that I was going to, and not allowed to go out with anybody who was anything connected to the church at the time. And we sort of got to know each other. I think I first got to met him in the September of 1989, and my dad died in the December of 1989. And I didn't really know him very well up until that point, until he sent me a Valentine card. I don't think kids send Valentine cards now. Do they? They don't particularly, do they? But he did. He sent me a mystery Valentine card, and I worked out who it was from. But we weren't allowed to go out, were we? And until Steve Chalk changed his mind, specially for us, and then let us go out. And we didn't get to go out until about the May. And this is a lesser-known fact. I think possibly my family and Ali Heath might know this fact. But Neil proposed to me 2 days after we started going out. And that was another journey of faith for me. So I said yes. In fact, I'd actually gone home that Easter and said to my mum, oh, I think I've met the man I'm going to marry, without knowing he was going to do this. And she said, oh, what have you, dear? I didn't know you were going out with anyone. I said, no, I'm not going out with him yet. So when he proposed to me, I knew it was the right thing to do. We didn't tell everyone straight away, did we? We sort of waited, because we thought they all might have heart failure. And which they probably would have done, but we did tell people within about 3 or 4 months of that, didn't we, and got engaged, and we were married a year later, and we've been happily married for 26 years. So, but again, that's a journey of faith. You know, I knew Neil was the right person for me. I just felt that God had given him to me. Interestingly, not long before I met Neil, I decided, I'd had a series of boyfriends, and I decided to have a break from men, and devote myself, just like Paul did, to the Word and living the life. And I'd actually said to God, this is what I'm going to do now. Don't worry about boys. And then Neil turned up. And my life then went on a different journey. And so I'm going to move on a little bit. So after we had got married, we were married for about 4 or 5 years before the children came along. And here comes another fried egg for us. It wasn't a big one, so I wasn't out in the frilly zone. I was in that stretch zone. I used to work as an HR manager up in the city, and Neil worked in a print shop initially, didn't you? And I had this big job with a big salary and eventually a company car. And at the time, I earned more than Neil. And I'd had Dan had come along, Sophie had come along. When Dan came along, I was quite glad to go back to work, because it's quite a challenge being at home when you've been working all the time with a baby. But then when Sophie came along, it was difficult. I found it more difficult to go back to work, so I wanted to spend more time with the children. We had a nanny come. She was actually from Orpington, believe it or not. And she definitely was Mary Poppins in disguise. When we interviewed her, she said, don't refer to me as Mary Poppins. And I thought, why not? You are Mary Poppins. And she actually was Mary Poppins in disguise. She was so organized, so much more organized than I was. But I found myself going to work and thinking, I don't want to hand my children over to anybody. I want to look after them myself. But we couldn't afford to do it. And then I got pregnant with Amy, and that desire to be at home with my children grew even stronger, actually. Amy was born in April on my birthday. In fact, this is another lesser-known fact. Some of you might know it, but I was born, me and my twin sister were born on my mum's birthday, and Amy was born on my birthday, so 4 of us on the same day. But before she was born, We'd had a bit of trouble with nannies. One, the Mary Poppins had gone off to university and we'd had to get someone else. And she was a lovely girl, but I just, that desire to look after my children was very strong. And I'd had a bit of time where I hadn't got proper childcare and that was very stressful. And so we sat down and thought, well, how much do we need to live off? Neil had, we prayed about it, Neil had a very small pay rise. And we sat down, looked at our finances, and it was almost to the penny what we needed for me to give up work. You know, it was going to be a bit of a struggle, but we did it. I went, and literally I went in the next day, told them I was pregnant, because I was about 5 months pregnant. I hadn't told them, but I was quite good at, I wasn't very big, so I was quite good at hiding it. They nearly had heart failure because I'd not long come back from having Sophie. And they said, oh, of course you will come back. And I was like, no, actually, I'm not going to. And there began a bit of a journey for me. I spent the next 5 or 6 years at home raising my children, having the privilege of bringing up my children. Loved every minute of it. And, you know, and I think that it's been, it's a very, it is a real privilege to be able to look after your children and not have to go to work. But once they grew up, we then moved to Orpington. And I wanted to, I didn't actually just want to be a stay-at-home mum with them being at school all the time. And that's when I, excuse me, sorry Malcolm, I was going to warn you if I coughed. And that's when I trained to become a teacher. And then shortly after that, in about 2009, came the next fried egg. And that, and many of you will know my brother Mark, because he came to be part of this fellowship. But only after he became ill, in about 2009, he phoned me up one day, very distressed. He'd been abroad. He came home early. He arrived at Gatwick and said, I'm coming. And he was very distressed. And he'd obviously had some experience while he was out in Thailand, where he realised he'd forgotten, become forgetful of something, and very, very frightened because of what had happened to my dad. And that then sent us on a 4 or 5 year journey with him, trying to get him diagnosed, get him the right, luckily living in London, getting him the right medical care. And we were very fortunate. At the time, he lived in Maida Vale on his own, actually, and we were down here, and I've got no other family down here. But I did have the support of a very special group of people, and that is the LPF group. So people like Pam, you were leading it at the time, Daphne Forrester, Diane, lots of women, praying women, Buck, Brian, I can name loads of you actually, praying women came around me and supported me in prayer, and that meant such a lot. And the prayer, you know, the times we've prayed, but that prayer began something for me to help me to understand how important it is for us to hold each other in prayer. So there were times, as those ladies know, where I just couldn't pray, I didn't know what to pray. And I'd go to the LPF meetings and say, right, this has happened to Mark. I need to get this sort of help, or I need to get him into this hospital, or I need to get an appointment for this or that or the other. And we would pray, and every single time we prayed, the prayer would be answered. And eventually Mark came. We got managed to get Mark a flat down in Orpington. Excuse me. And that was an answer to prayer in itself. We needed somewhere that was not too expensive, that was, because by then he was quite forgetful, that was near the end of the high street, and so that he could locate himself and we could find where he was if, you know, he got a bit lost. And we prayed and prayed, and then eventually this flat came up. And it's actually opposite Tesco's, above, on the corner as you go into the high street, there's a Chinese restaurant, I can't think what it's called, and there's some flats above there. And luckily for Mark, it was right opposite Tesco, so he would come out, go straight into Tesco's, get some coffee, because that was his favourite thing to do, And the bless them, the people in Tesco's were wonderful with him, and the people in Costa, and lots of you guys. I know people would come, Bimby would come and say, I've just seen Mark, we've had a coffee with him. And it kept him safe, Tesco's, because it was right outside his front door. But he deteriorated very, very quickly, unfortunately. So that was a real test of faith, you know, to have that experience with my dad, and then 20 years later to be going through the same experience with my brother. And then in 2013, March 2013, sadly he passed away. And that's where I sort of... And that's hard enough in itself, actually. But that's where I felt that... I'm just going to go back to that. This verse here. Don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow's got enough worries. Just concentrate on today. That's where that verse became really real for me. Because the few months later... it's slightly out of order. My mum became very ill, and this is where I entered from the stretch zone into the frilly zone. So that's a picture of my mum when she was about 19, I think, and that's her at 90. She lived a long and good life, but sadly she died of just a few months after my brother. I think she found it very difficult to cope with him going. She was really looking forward to being 90. We had a big family celebration. Then almost the second after her 90th birthday passed, she just said, I don't want to be 90. And she just went downhill from that moment on, really. And sadly, she passed away in the August. And it was... So that was hard enough, having to lose two members of my family at the same time. But I really relied on... my faith, the people around here, having the support of other Christians, so important. Because once again, people came round us and loved us and looked after us. And this is why I'm really in the frilly zone at this point. Oh, there's a couple of pictures here of my family. That's Mark and my mum together. He was ill at that point, actually. It was at my niece's wedding. And that's me and my brothers, now all grown up. My sister lives in Australia, which is why she's not there. And then here came the next fried egg. As you know, Neil got very ill. So he was diagnosed with cancer 2 weeks after my mum's funeral. And it was almost like a runaway train, you know, getting battered time and time again. People often say to me, you know, how do you cope with it? I had a friend at work, actually, it's an amazing way of giving your testimony. I was out for a work sort of meal. I very rarely go out with my teacher friends because they like to drink a lot and I don't particularly. So I try not to go out with them very much because they like to drink a lot and it's not very attractive at the end of it all. But I did go out that night. They were going out for a meal in Bromley, to a restaurant, Indian restaurant. So I decided to go along, and I'm really glad I did, because one of my friends came up to me. He knew about all the things that I've been doing, and she said to me, you know, can I ask you how has what's happened to you affect your faith? And I said, well, actually, that's really easy to give you that answer, because it's actually made my faith stronger, if anything. You know, coming back to what Keith was saying in his talk in January, God's power is made perfect in our weakness. You know, for when I'm weak, you are strong. And I had to rely, when Neil was ill, I had to go to work because Neil's self-employed, so he wasn't working for 10 months. So I had to earn the money. I had three children at secondary school, one doing GCSEs, another doing A-levels. I had to try and keep the house in order, keep things sane and normalised as best I could for my children, and try and keep a bit of a level head and a handle on life and not allow life to just run away with me, which it felt like it was a lot of the time. And I won't... Ali, you're going to laugh. I'm not going to lie. we were talking about this, I think teenagers today, I'm not going to lie. There were times when I looked around at my friends and I thought, how come we're going through all of this and nobody else did? You know, I'm not superhuman. I've had those doubts. I've had those questions. And I did find it really, really difficult. I'll be completely honest with you. But I found comfort in God's word. People were really good. They'd send me a card from time to time, and it was often just the right thing. I remember Daphne sending me a little card one day saying, you know, sometimes you can't pray for yourself, so just allow us to pray for you. And I remember feeling like I was sat in God's hands at that point, and I just relaxed into that and thought, okay, God, there you go. And I learned a really important lesson through all of that. And this is biblical, it says it in the Bible, and it's something to do with that Matthew chapter 6 verses, I think. Bimbi, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. That you need to learn to live life day by day. The heart of those verses, the verses that converted me to be a Christian, was about don't let life's worries drag you down. Only worry about what you've got to worry about for today, and tomorrow will take care of itself. And I learned to do that on a daily basis, and pretty much that's what's happened. You know, I found I had enough money in the bank to pay the bills. From time to time, money would appear in an envelope through the door, which was a real blessing, and I saved that money. I don't know, I've got no idea who gave us money, but if it's any of you guys, I'll tell you what I did with it. I saved it so that when my children needed to go out, if they were going out with push or they were going to do something together with their friends, I used all that money for them so they got to do the things that all the other teenagers got to do. So that was a real blessing for us. People gathered around us, they brought meals round, which for me, the one thing that I found really, really difficult was putting a meal on the table. I'm good at cooking, I'm good at doing the shopping and getting the food in, but I just found that almost impossible. It's the one area of life I found very difficult. Coming home from work, especially when Neil was in Guy's, coming home from work, feeding the children, going down to the station, jumping on a train, going to see Neil, coming back at, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night, going to bed, getting up the next morning, going to work, doing it all over again. And that went on for weeks and months. He did come home after a couple of weeks, then he was in and out of hospital, various operations and things. But, you know, the support of the people here was really important for me. The other thing that I found really important was worship. I've always been a worshipper. I've loved worship. I'm part of the worship group here. I was part of the worship group in my last church. What I'd do, and I was reading a book by Joyce Huggett, which talked about, I'm going to get this wrong, Brother Lawrence? Yeah, and who is a friar that lived back in the 12th century or something like that, or 15th century. And he learnt to live in the moment. And I think I learnt a lot from Brother Lawrence, live in the moment. People would come from all over. I think he was French or Belgian or something like that, would travel from all over Europe to find him and talk to him. And he just worked in the kitchens of the monastery. And during his time in the kitchens, he would be living in the moment, trying to enter God's presence. So being thankful for the fact he was peeling sprouts, being thankful for every moment that he had. And I tried a bit of that, and it made a big difference to me. I remember cooking a chili, doing it, being thankful for stirring the onions. And it just brought me into the presence of God in a way that I never could have otherwise done. And nobody really knew that that was happening. My kids were doing their thing. But I was standing in my kitchen in God's presence in the kingdom. So I can highly recommend him to you. And sometimes I'd just put worship music on. When things got really difficult and the tears flowed and I still had to cook a meal or I still had to do the marking for work, I'd whack a worship CD on and I would worship my way through the pain. And I always found that putting worship music on just brought me into the presence of God. And I've continued to do that, really. And that's how I got through that year or so. And it's not just that year, because when you lose two people, and then your husband gets cancer. The following year, I went to New Wine, and someone, I think it was Mike Pilavarci, said, oh, there's someone here who's been through three bereavements. He said, it's really unusual, but we think we need to pray for that person. And I immediately knew that that was me. Although Neil was still with me, it was like a bereavement, what I'd been through. And that's the only way I could get through that. And it's when you've been through that, you can't just get over it in a year. It's taken me years. I'm still going through managing the grief and managing the fried egg. I'm on my way back to that yellow zone now. You'll be pleased to hear. But sometimes I go out into the stretch zone. Oh, this is Woody. Woody sadly died. He's my cat. I love cats. But Woody was very special to me. He died about, not last autumn, the autumn before. And when we had a team from, I want to say Bethel, or someone here. Was it Bethel? And there was a prayer meeting for the prayer ministers the following morning. And I walked in and I was a bit upset about him going, if I'm honest. But I didn't feel too bad until I walked into that prayer meeting and they prayed and they played Your Grace is Enough, which was a song that we'd played at my brother and my mother's funeral. And at that moment, the grief, not just for my cat, but the grief that I'd been through just completely overwhelmed me to the point I had to go and lie on a sofa while all this worship and prayer was going on. I don't know if you remember, Anthony, I was lying there for about half an hour just crying. But I felt that was a very healing thing for me. You know, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Your cat dies, and that's the key to some healing. And I've had other moments like that. Bless him, Woody. And so now, I've still got more fried eggs. There's lots of things in my life that are stretching me at the moment. I've got problems with my health at the moment, which is annoying. I'm not in the frilly zone with it, but I'm hoping to get, sorted out. I've got teenage children growing up and all those things. There's some of those are stretching us at the moment and the decisions that they're taking. And there's a future for me and Neil. I don't know what the future holds for us. I know in terms of Neil's health. We're facing the empty nesting syndrome soon, so watch out for that, everybody. any advice would be greatly received. So I don't think the fried eggs go away, but you learn to manage them, and my faith's been really important in that. So what I'm going to ask you guys to do now is just think about, I've got a few questions for you. So I want you to think about when life gets difficult, what's your first reaction to when life brings some worries? Because we have a human reaction. I know what my reaction has been, and I've learnt to temper it. And then how can you let God take the strain when life does get difficult, when life deals its worst? And then thinking about that verse, seek first God's kingdom, what does that look like for you on a daily basis? So that's the first three questions. And then there's a couple more, and there's a little activity for you. Being a teacher, I couldn't let you get by without a little activity for you to get involved in. So I've got some trusty helpers who will bring round, if I just explain it, a couple more questions. So this is the activity really. So I want you to think about, how's God stretching you today? In today's, it could be a small thing, it could be a big thing. And what's your response? And then we're going to bring round some little fried eggs. I've got a little fried egg. Oh, sorry, Malcolm, I've got a little fried egg for you there. My little helpers will come round and put some fried eggs on the table, some pens. If you've got your own pen, that would be great. And then perhaps just as a sort of act of worship, really, when you've written something on your fried egg, keep it, you don't put your name on it, fold it up. I've put the cross there, come and put it at the foot of the cross in the bin. I'm not going to read them, I'll arrange for them to be destroyed. And then when you finish that, a little treat for you, I've got some little fried egg sweets. So, and I thought, you can take a couple of fried egg sweets, and I thought, it's quite a nice symbol, but it's sort of something to do with the sweetness of God. Allow the sweetness of God just to enter your life. So I'm going to leave you with those questions. And Neil's going to play some music, I think, or somebody is, hopefully, quietly. All yours.